Greg Casey joins me this week to discuss the history of American lager. This is Beersmith Podcast number 248.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 248, and it's early December 2021. Greg Casey joins me this week to discuss the rich history of American lagers. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I'm happy to say the web-based version of Beersmith is available now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. The new web version gives you access to tens of thousands of recipes, online recipe editing, advanced water tools, and much more. You can try Beersmith Web for 30 days by setting up an account at beersmithrecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version of Beersmith for one low price. Check out beersmithrecipes.com now to give Beersmith Web a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Dr. Greg Casey. Greg holds a PhD in applied microbiology from the University of Saskatchewan and has held academic positions as well as positions with Anheuser-Busch, Red Star Yeast, Stroh Brewery, and Coors. He was also president of the American Society of Brewing Chemists from 2005 to 2006. And I think, Greg, now you said you're retired, right?
Yeah, I retired back in 2013. And well done on this Saskatchewan. Most people sort of stumbled through that one. So well done.
Yeah, yeah. I spent some time in Canada. I think you're from Toronto, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. How did you get interested in the history of American lagers as a topic? Because most people don't really dive into that very much.
No, that's a good point. It's like, why delve into a style of beer that's kind of going against the current? The current interest in craft styles, for example, is obviously well-deserved. And why would somebody delve into what took place 100 years ago, even longer? What sparked my interest was related to a job-related event. I had roles in research as well as quality assurance. And typically, with caustic contamination, a sodium test is something that we always used to refer to in case we suspected the caustic wasn't rinsed out of the tank. And so I did a Google search for adulteration, seeing if there was any, more definitive test methods, more objective, right? Well, not more objective, but different than the sodium test, which requires a process survey capability and knowing what normal levels are, et cetera. And then I saw a hit for the Turner adulteration bill, and it was 1890. And I opened it up, and that's what started what is now a 14-year journey and nearly 17,000 primary period references into the debate in American society. Particularly in the decades, a half century before Prohibition, over the simple question of what is beer. And I got hooked. And I've always had an interest in history. I asked Bill Coors if he'd ever heard of the controversial nature of the use of corn and rice in the 1800s. And he said he had no idea. So I figured Bill didn't know. Nobody did. So and in retirement, you're always looking for something to fill in those years with a passion, right? So for me, I decided, okay, I got to tell this story. I'm going to write this story. And, maybe towards the end, this is not for profit. I won't make a penny out of this, but it's a passion. And it combines my passion of brewing with the history of the United States.
That's very cool. Why did you dive into American lager though, in particular? Is that, it wasn't the dominant style until like the mid 1800s, right?
It's Genesis. The all malt lagers are the 1840s, and then the Pilsner from 1870s on. And the Pilsner was, you know, the one that was overwhelmingly made with adjuncts, because that was the beer of the period. You know, in terms of lager, that's where the research took me. By the last decades of the 19th century, the overwhelming majority, the vast majority of the beer sold in the United States of America was adjunct lager beer, Pilsner style. And so the context was that. And all the debate was focused on lager. I really didn't. They were using adjuncts and ales too, but you know, just mostly in the northeast part of the United States. But overwhelmingly, it was a lager world, and it was lager, adjunct lager, that made beer, as they repeatedly called it in the press, America's national beverage, adjunct lager beer.
And I mean, we discount it today, but a lot of, you know, American lager is still the dominant form of beer, right, here in the United States.
Yeah, I kind of touch on this in the first volume because, I don't want to say I'm being a little bit flippant, but I'm kind of like, well, you know, it's still 80% of the, you know, craft is 20-ish or something like that, and adjunct, domestic, and imported as a style, it's still there. But on a global basis, I mean, it's waxing. It's still growing. You know, I used to lecture in China and Snow Lager, the world's most popular style of beer. It was like, to me, it tastes like a Miller Genuine Draft. But adjunct lager beer, particularly, you know, reflective of, if you associate that with the United States in terms of, you know, setting the hook as a permanent style, you know, so many countries have adopted our beer, is the way I look at it, Canada in particular. I never thought growing up I'd see Bud Light and Bud and Coors Light is the top two brands of beer in Canada. Well, they are, you know, and so, yeah, as a style, it's still got legs globally, but domestically it's been chipped away at. But like I said, you know, as a style, 80% is still pretty good.
And I mean, it's really the dominant style worldwide, isn't it? Almost.
It is. Yeah, on a global basis. And I have a table in the first volume showing that, you know, the top 20, you know, top 25 brands of beer in the world. I think virtually all but one of them, and Heineken, just because they went back to all malt. They used to be adjunct brewers, but they changed that policy a number of years ago. But adjunct lager beers, you bet, they're the dominant style. And confirmation of this, it was a friend of mine in Dumans in Munich. And I was sitting around the fire pit with him the other year. He was here for a CBC in Denver. And, you know, I was telling him, I said, a lot of folks say American beer doesn't have any history. Doesn't have any, you know, roots. It's being developed now. And he chastised me. He said, well, how could you say that? He said, we just did, Dimmons just did a global survey of the most popular styles of beer in the world. And he said, it is your beer. Is adjunct lager beer? That's the beer of the world. So how could you say you have no history and or no, you know, no culture of beer, if you will? You may not like the style, but in terms of just raw numbers and consumers making purchasing decisions, it's a style that was perfected here and has been adopted by the world.
So, I mean, that's pretty amazing. So, American lager arguably is the world's most popular beer style. Even though we look down upon it, right? We kind of look down over nose on it as craft beer enthusiasts. We kind of ignore the American beer heritage, really, which goes back, some 160 years here, right?
Yeah, and I have a real passion for this. Again, this comes out in the first volume. I got a whole chapter called just entitled "Jokes and Critics." You know, it's the Rodney Dangerfield of beer styles, right? Don't get no respect, and I get that. It's, you know, having on the technical side, seeing how difficult it is to make, I have respect for it. But on a consumer side, I realize, well, there's not a lot to it. You know, it's pretty subtle compared to every other style of beer in the world. But what we have, I have a real passion in the book to draw attention to the fact that, and I used you a golfer, Brad, but the Masters, the green jacket, right? You know, Germany has a green jacket with their name on it. Belgium does, and England, but the United States, we don't have that jacket. You know, we don't have dibs to a history or a culture of contributing to the global beer community. And I think it's a pity that we've lost, or we don't have that sense, not just even within the industry, but within the American public as a whole. You know, and I think we're giving to the wine industry and distilling industry sort of bragging rights for having an American heritage and American culture as an industry. And I think if people knew how hard it was fought for, because that's one thing people respect, is something that is fought for and defended, and the underdog against overwhelming forces, And remarkably, that's the story of American Adjunct Lager beer. So I really, really, really hope that what comes out of this trilogy is an awareness that there is a green jacket which says the United States of America. It's just that it's adjunct lager beer, not the styles of Belgium, Germany, and England.
Now, where does the American lager story really begin?
It really, that's, it's kind of a little bit lost in the mystery of time or of history, the fog of history. But I believe it was just in the late 1830s, certainly by the early 1840s, 41, 42. There's in most overwhelmingly in Pennsylvania, but there's also literature that said it could have been in Cincinnati and other cities where German communities were at the time. But that was the start of lager in the United States. Everything up to that point in time was ale, porters, and stouts, but really just an infinitesimally small part of the overall alcoholic beverage category in the United States. And it was an all malt. It was a Dunkel style. It was brewed for the German community by German brewers. It didn't expand to you Americans, and I'll maybe talk about that in a minute. You know, the non-German, the non-Deutsch, non-Deutschman or Dutchman. But by the 1870s, that is when Pilsner exploded across the Western world. It wasn't just a United States thing, but Pilsner, you know, spread out across the world. Helles and, you know, and Bavaria was a recognition of that. But everywhere in the Western world, Pilsner evolved. And that was 1870s in the United States when it hit here. And that's the beer that took beer from virtually nothing as an overall category to a per capita. And per capita at a time when the population was massively expanding, right? It became the beer of all Americans, not just the German communities. But 1870s, that's when it really, really started, the Pilsner, and specifically the use of adjuncts.
So, I mean, what drove that? What made this beer style that was, you know, kind of small and in a lot of German-American communities explode into the dominant style that we have today?
You know, that's a really good question, Brad. And definitely there's so much of American culture that really influenced the evolution of it as a style that didn't happen in other countries. For example, you know, Americans, we typically like to drink, and this is, you know, this kind of knowledge is found in the transcripts of the hearings, Senate hearings and House hearings about why do you use adjuncts? I'm not making this up, but, you know, the book, you see the actual quote.
Right.
But, you know, they talk about the, and I had to look up some words. These guys are pretty sophisticated. The you know, the aesthetic as well as the Epicurean values of adjunct lager beer. And I'm like, what the hell is that? You know, Epicurean. Well, that's the part. You know, how it tastes, but the aesthetics, how it looked, and that was a major factor. You know, Pilsner was an easier style to drink for one thing. And the Germans talk about when they visited here in the 19th century, the rush style of Americans. We are an anxious people compared to, you know, German culture, German society. But we didn't need beer for nutrition. We used it for refreshment. And, you know, they visiting Germans say it pained them to watch an American, how quickly they would quaff a beer. But they were quaffing a beer in a glass. You know, it was a glass and you could see the beer. You know, in Germany, you know, beer gardens, you're typically drinking out of steins. You didn't see it. There was an expression, Americans drink beer with their eyes. Germans drink beer with their tongues. And that was an expression said in right around 1900. And that really captures why in the United States, we wanted a beer that was crystal clear when it was ice cold, right or wrong. But that's how you start seeing ads for ice cold beer in the 1870s onwards. And only American brewers figured out two things, how to do it, keep it crystal clear when it was ice cold fresh, but also to shipping it to Arizona or any part of the United States of America several months later, it was still crystal clear when it was put on ice. And German after German after German expert in the 1890s to 1910s, they said no beer in Europe can do this. You know, but the industry had a reason to be able to deliver that to their consumers, and that was the American preference.
Now, I don't know if this is true, but I was told that glassware, you know, like clear glassware was not commonly available to average people in the 1700s, for example. And it wasn't until the 1800s that you begin to have relatively cheap glassware available to the average person.
Yeah, that's my understanding. Pardon me. That's my understanding as well. But certainly by the last decades of the 19th century, you know, glass was the ubiquitous serving container that was at the saloons. And, you know, they obviously you could have growlers and things like that. But beer, but most of the beer was consumed on site, on premise, as opposed to home use. That kind of was more of a later development in terms of the percentage, and the bottles were brown, so you didn't see it. But even with the, you know, the brown beer bottles, you see it in their advertising, you know, pour it into a glass and see if it's clear. You know, this is chill proof. The term chill proof was repeatedly referred to in ads in the 1900s and 1910s, those two decades.
And I believe the dominant styles before this were primarily English styles, right? Things like 100%. Porters and browns, right?
India pale ales. But, you know, the thing that really, you know, saw those disappear from the American scene, not disappear totally, of course, but they're being revived now. But, you know, they were higher alcohol, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of being able to preserve and have a stable product to give to consumers, they were less quaffable, if you will. I mean, they were a style that just didn't suit the overall population as the explosion of immigration in the last decades of the 19th century. So it just, you know, they just dropped off the radar screen. And it was kind of fascinating to see. I didn't realize that. But, and again, it was a tiny fraction when you compare it to, you know, rum, Madeira, whiskey, and everything else. We needed prohibition. We were a pretty naughty nation, you know, in terms of, you know, and the Germans kept reinforcing, hey, trust us, drink lager. You know, you're not going to get drunk all the time. But even when lager came, even in the 1860s, the Union Army, right at the start of the Civil War, for a number of months allowed lager beer to be consumed by the troops in camp as they considered it non-alcoholic. So low in alcohol, relatively speaking, to the ales, porters, and stouts. But then, you know, it didn't take long for a couple of generals to go, hey, I think these guys can drink enough of this. But for a few months, and there was a big debate in society and the New York Times newspapers, is lager beer intoxicating? That low alcohol, relatively speaking, compared to, you know, so you could quaff it, you could refresh it, you can drink more of it. It just had so many advantages to the American people at that time that, and like I said, it expanded. They kept saying in their testimony defending it, you Americans, we make an all malt beer for us, but you Americans, meaning, you know, multi-generational citizens of every ethnicity, demand it.
Now, can you go back and talk about the German influence here in the origins of American lager? And it's interesting. I think we were talking before the show, but you know, we often think of Germany and the Rheinheitsgebot and you know, the purity laws and so on. But those didn't come until later, right?
Yeah, it's an important point because in the second volume, which I've written but not been published, won't be published till John Palmer, my editor, gets through it for 2022. But I talk about the Rheinheitsgebots, plural. You know, the certainly Bavaria 1516 is the most famous, but Bavaria, you know, when you look at the German Empire as a whole, the vast majority of the English, the German population in the German Empire from 1871 onwards were free to use adjuncts. And that was, you know, Prussia, all the other German states, duchies, Grand Dukes, whatever the hell they were, but they were, most of Germany was using adjuncts right up until 1906, when in June 1906, and they were. It's fascinating reading, and I talk about this in one of my MBA papers. The Reichstag made no bones about it. It was part of the imperial financial reforms of 1906 to fund the expansion of the German Empire's navy, and they didn't mince. You know, it was a dramatic increase in the beer tax. They standardized it. They eliminated the categories that existed since 1871 when Bismarck set up Germany as his first chancellor. We will tax rice. We will tax sugars. We will tax corn. We will tax syrups. We will tax malt. 1906, for the whole empire, is just malt. All these other categories, particularly for lager, were eliminated. And it was a dramatic increase. And I don't see any evidence it was done for anything other than financial reasons, follows the money. But during that period then, the 1840s up to 1906, it's fascinating. German after German, when they're testifying, when asked, when did you first brew using rice, for example, you know, they talk about breweries in Heidelberg or Northern Germany, or, you know, they don't talk about Bavaria, but they were talking about other regions where it was quite commonly used. And they brought that expertise over with them. And it's just a really fascinating, it's a part of history that we just don't, I didn't know anything about it. that this overlapping and the influence of so many German brewers had already been versed. It wasn't something that Anton Schwartz, who's often associated as being the father of adjunct brewing, sort of introduced to America. No, that he was a disciple already of prophets in various institutions in Europe that were advocating the use of adjuncts, including potatoes, beet sugar, and rice.
So, I mean, ultimately, this style was started in Germany, right? And then carried over by German immigrants, right?
Yeah, I'd say, Brad, I'd say the 1850s, we've got documentation that as early as the 1850s, it preceded the use of adjuncts by about a decade or two in the United States. But there's this fascinating Ludwig von Haeker, who's a professor in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, who had a patent on the use of, they called it Indian corn, but it was just corn, right? And he traveled to the United States in 1863, which, as you know, was kind of the height of the Civil War. And he stayed here 10, 11 months to promote his patent to brew using corn as an adjunct with American breweries. And I, about 8-9 months ago, I just came across a book he wrote describing his experiences. And he names, you know, breweries. And, you know, he talks about being run out of in Indianapolis when the local German community got wind of that they're going to do some test brews with corn as an adjunct to brew lager. They literally got run out of town. But he also talks about breweries in virtually every state east of the Mississippi. He went both north and south. You know, he talks about, you know, being a corn guy. He was like, he was distraught with what he saw in terms of Union prisoners just being fed one cob of corn a day. There's a vibe. Little stories like that really kind of resonate with me. But so there was evidence even as early as 1863 that adjuncts were introduced here. But in terms of really taking off, it was 1870s here, 1850s in Germany.
Wow. What were some of the early American lagers like? What did they were they different than what we're drinking today?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. You know, like everything else in terms of fashion and evolution, adjunct lager beer as a category. What a consumer would have experienced in the 1870s and 1910s and 1930s and during the war and right up to the American light lager has evolved. But it's fair to say that, you know, looking at the first Pilsner, 1870s, certainly, you know, there was it was either the foam in those products was strong for a reason, because, you know, they were typically using more materials per barrel. It was a heavier beer. Higher real extract. Alcohol was marginally at first slightly higher than today, but in the years prior to Prohibition, pretty much it set on the alcohol levels that we have today. So the beer then would have looked a little darker in the glass. It would have had a beautiful head on the top of the glass. Things you wouldn't associate with a Coors Light or Bud Light by any means today. So it definitely has evolved, and part of it was consumer driven. Part of it was, you know, the years before Prohibition, and an effort to sort of, hey, this is the beverage of moderation. So that's sort of alcohol level we have today was really, really becoming standardized in the United States then.
What are some of the myths associated with American lager? And I think you have quite a list of them if you've put in the book, right?
I paraphrase them as the 5W Kool-Aid. And it's all based on, you know, sort of drinking the Kool-Aid, if you believe what you read on the internet is exclusively true. But the myths, you know, starting with the when, we've talked about that. You know, there's a common myth that the use of adjuncts started during World War II when malt was hard to get. And clearly, you know, in 1862, the United States government required to help fund the Civil War, required every brewer in the United States to record for the $1 beer tax the amount of materials used per pound, per brew, per day, per year. We get, you know, one thing the Treasury Department's good at,
I think we're still doing that, aren't we?
We are. It's to this day, but that started in 1862. It was a significant percentage of the funding for the Union forces during the Civil War. So we have all this data, and you look you compare, it really didn't change much between the 1890s, and I have a table for the amounts annual in 1896. In 1940, before the war, the year before Pearl Harbor. And they're virtually the same percentage in terms of ratio of malt adjunct. So the when is clearly, that myth is, it started World War II. Kind of debunked that in the book. The where, we've talked about that. Germany, you know, the where says it started here. It's America's stigma and stain, if you will, on the beer world. But, well, you know, the Deutsch have the divs on that in terms of evolution of that. And maybe not even the Deutsch, but, the Czech. Because, you know, Balling himself, sort of synonymous with home and craft and macro brewers. I mean, he was experimenting with potatoes in the brewing of lager beer in the mid 19th century. So that one's debunked. There's often a belief that American lager beer before Prohibition bore no resemblance to the beer that is modern today. It was mostly a world of continuing to be ales, porters, and stouts, and that it was not the beer of adjunct lager beer. So we talk about that. The who, and that's a big one. You know, the who question is, well, why? You know, why and who? So the other two W's, right? Who drove this? Was it the consumers, or was it the brewers? As many posts say, it was sort of a greedy exploitation of the use in rice and corn during the malt to continue it after the war to keep it to maximize profits and blah, 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 blah. But when you go back, and again, we have all this in their own words and in the testimonies and the transcripts, 1870s, 1880s, it was a more expensive beer to make adjunct lager beer compared to all malt beer. And they talk about it. And they charge more for saloons. And so at the genesis, during those vital years when it was first developed for quite a time, it was more expensive on an extract basis and process, you know, cookers and things like that, that from a brewer's perspective. And they made it abundantly clear that it was the consumers who were, take this all malt beer back from the saloons, and these are their quotes, it won't sell, give us the, they call it the Pilsner, but it was the adjunct lager Pilsner of the time. So, that's a big, whereas there's a fairly detailed academic study, the shipper versus local, that the shippers, you know, the Budweisers, the Pabsts, and, you know, the Schlitzes and the big brewers, you know, drove across the nation the use of adjunct lager beer with local communities in a perfect world, brewing only all malt beers for their local constituents. Well, that ain't true, because you look at, you know, I've went through every journal, every page, because they always wrote about who was installing what in technology and what town in America and what brewery, and it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, approaching 1,000 brewers just between the 1880s and 1910s that were installing cookers. And, you know, it's just in smallest communities. It was a pretty standard. The generic American brew house was pretty well set by the 1880s on, and an integral part of that for the vast majority were the integration of cookers for the brewing of adjunct lager beer.
And another interesting fact you mentioned was America is arguably the inventor of ice cold beer, right?
Yeah, I don't know if you've heard of a guy or come across whose name was. Have you heard of the Wal Henius School in Chicago?
I have not, but
yeah, it was. Have you heard of Siebel's?
Of course, yeah, of course.
Yeah, it's basically Siebel was a competitor in Chicago of Wal Henius, of the Wal Henius Brewing School.
Interesting.
And something like 70% of the brewmasters were trained there in the last decades of the 19th century and of Prohibition. Including, you know, the families of the Carlsberg and Heineken family sent their kids over to the United States to learn how to brew adjunct lager beer. Wow. They were trained as brewers in the United States, things you wouldn't expect. But then, you know, they're interviewed by the paper and newspapers, Chicago Tribune, and, you know, it's pretty cool when you think of it. But where was I going?
We're talking about ice cold beer.
Yeah. Yeah, the guy, the Henius, Dr. Max Henius, Aquavit, he was the son of the distiller Aquavit in Denmark. He came over here to the United States, and when he wrote his biography, he described being struck as he came into New York Harbor. There were advertisements in abundance for remedies to deal with dyspepsia, I think it was called, the adverse effects of drinking ice cold water. You know, that there were all these posters and advertisements. This is pre Statue of Liberty, but he was struck by the fact that this ice cold emphasis was an American thing. And it definitely was. It was deeply rooted. Beer didn't start it. You know, beer wasn't the reason, you know, ice cold started in the United States. We had a penchant for it culturally. Maybe it was, you know, particularly climate driven, being for much of the United States being hotter than many European countries, but ice cold was an American deal, and it carried on into beer.
That's interesting. Well, how did the American lager style evolve over time to become the style we have today? You mentioned it was nothing like what we drink today, really, in the 1840s.
Yeah, it definitely did have these periods of growth. You know, American lager, the all malt, you know, from the 1840s to 1870s was on a per capita relatively small, but Dunkel style, but it was mostly consumed within the German-American community.
Right.
But from the 1870s right up to, say, 1910s, there's this explosive growth where it was Pilsner as a style. So as a style, Pilsner lager beer, you know, rocked the lager industry in the United States. But in the decades leading up to Prohibition, many, many states implemented state-level prohibition, right? So, you know, there was a gradual lightening of the adjunct lager beer in those two decades before. So slightly lower alcohol content compared to the 1870s to 1890s adjunct. Then Prohibition, you know, the near beer, the dark days. And then there's a fact, and I touch on this in the volume one, briefly talk about the period between 1933 and repeal with the start of World War One. World War II. That was a period of actually the highest extract and brewing materials per barrel of lager in the history of the United States.
Wow.
Even more than the 1870s. I call it kind of like brewers gone wild. And again, it all gets back to government statistics, right? You've got these numbers. So, you know, you just sort of lay it out. Here's what it was in the 1870s and here's what it was in 1933. And it's remarkable during that period with one of what I call it to consider the heaviest adjunct lager beer in terms of extract and body and the way that it would be perceived. You know, as you would expect, 1933 beer took off and then it stopped. It started to decline. I mean, and nowhere near the per capita levels it was pre-prohibition up until 1941. And then there was this period of forced lightness. I call it forced lightness because what the industry had to deal with during this time was, okay, malt was essentially fixed at 100% of pre-World War II, pre-Pearl Harbor. And that just didn't change throughout the whole war. But what was really difficult to get was adjuncts, corn and rice. And that started a period between 1941 and 48, we were using adjuncts we didn't typically use, flake barley, raw barley, barley grits, kaffir corn, milo maize, I'm not sure how you say it, cassava and potatoes and you name it. And what happened during that period of forced, there was a 60% growth of the industry from 41 to 48, 60%.
In terms of volume, I think, right?
In terms of volume, yeah. I mean, it'd be like today, another 120 million barrels of beer being sold in the United States in what, 2029 or something like that. I mean, it was a phenomenal period of growth, and the beer, particularly in the middle years when it was exploding, was essentially a 50-50 adjunct malt adjunct lager beer, where everything preceding that was, well, you know, in the 70s or 60s 70s kind of deal. And it's fascinating, I talk about this in the first volume, the brewers are going, well, why? You know, why from their perspective, this was the, you know, not the beer they wanted to make. And they returned right after the war, or 48, after we didn't have to feed the world. And not have to, but we chose to as a nation. I'm very proud of that, you know, in terms of care, when restrictions on grain ended. And it came back. It came back, but it didn't quite come back to that. Remember that period between 33 and 41?
Yeah.
It was a little lighter. And then it just went in kind of on a per capita basis, a very relatively slow decline, still significant volume. Mm-hmm. But then the directed light by choice, you know, the advent, the evolution of the modern American light lager, boom, took off. And only then did we get to pass the per capita and volume numbers pre-prohibition.
Wow.
You know, and I call this the sort of the march to lightness. So to summarize your question in three words, Brad, march to lightness is the way that I describe the evolution from the 1840s right up to today. And now we're with the craft community getting into it. I, you know, the lagers that I have, and every time I go and I get an opportunity to take a craft lager, I do. You know, I'd say that beer is more akin to the 1870s to 1890s style of lager.
Interesting. Well, popularity of the beer, I would argue, particularly in the 1800s, was organically driven. But there's this perception that, you know, kind of after Prohibition, that the big breweries kind of shoved it down our throat. Is that actually true or not?
Absolutely, it is not true.
Yeah, I didn't think so. And,
I have a chapter that it's called Legacies Denied. Mm-hmm. You know, because I believe that the legacies of these individuals, this generation of German Americans who gave us beer as a national beverage, and specifically adjunct lager beer, their legacies are being denied by that paradigm. You know, that it was forced down, that it was only the Bud Miller Coors and the big boys and Schlitz and all that. Nothing could be further from the truth. But as I start that chapter, I started with just one word: pointless. Period. I say it's kind of like I used to tell my kids when they were young, it's pointless to try to convince somebody otherwise. You know, when they were trying to convince their father that I should do this and they, you know, I didn't want to. And I say, hey, pointless. This argument is over. And I know that's going to be probably one of the hardest paradigms to address. So that's where the heart and soul of the trilogy, well, I'll leave it to the American people who hopefully read this trilogy to like the style of beer, make up their mind when they hear, and I use extensively the quotes and the words of the people of this time, why they made that style of beer, why they used adjuncts, what it meant to the country, what it meant to the style. And I'll leave it up to the Americans. For me, just to say to you today, that's absolutely false. I understand it's pointless. Most people will say, yeah, right, you spent your time there, blah, blah, blah. Well, read the history and read what they said and just feel the history, because that's the emphasis of these books. It's really about their journeys as Americans, their legacies, and their legacies that have really carried over to the second American beer revolution, which is the craft revolution.
Pre-Prohibition, were we brewing a wide variety of styles, or were we still primarily brewing lager?
Yeah, it was lager, but within the lager, they were more diverse. You could still get Dortmunder and Kolsch, and, you know, you could still see relatively small percentages of those styles of beers brewed largely for German-American communities. So there was a broader portfolio, if you will, at the time. And then, you know, the ales and porters and stouts were still being brewed in Massachusetts and the Northeast. So it was definitely a more, I'd say it was fair to say that lager as a category was somewhere between 90 and 95% of all the beer sold in America going into Prohibition. And the vast majority of that was Pilsner style with adjuncts. But you could also still get Dortmunder, but, you know, Peels in New York City, for example, but they use rice even in that. There were more styles available at the time. And that's a kind of a beautiful thing with the craft revolution, is it's reviving many of those other traditional German styles in addition to Pilsner.
And obviously the craft beer revolution has eaten into the traditional American lager share, at least. But what are some of the factors that really contributed to the rise of craft beer starting, I think, in the 80s?
Boy, that's a really good question. And here I'll probably be, you know, more tapping into my personal paradigms and my beliefs as I talk about this in one of the later volumes. I believe, but for the traumatic events of the 20th century. You know, you had Prohibition, you had the First World War. And by the way, First World War, there was a period of like 6-7 months where Hoover demanded brewers only make all malt lager to use to save corn and rice for famine relief in Belgium, for example. Sorry, I'm diverging.
No, it's but, okay.
Yeah, so that's kind of a cool piece of history. But,
We're talking about the factors that drove the craft beer revolution, really.
I speculate in 1900, July 1900, there was this young brewer who wrote to a guy by the name of Dr. Ernst Henke, who, like Siebel's and Walhenius, had a brewing school, a brewing station of research and education, mm-hmm. training brewers. And a letter to the brewer, to this Dr. Henke, in July 1900, said, how can a small brewer succeed in America, given by then the ubiquitous application of adjunct lager beer and brew house design and beer styles of the beer that was being sold in America? And he wrote back to this unnamed individual, but small brewer who wanted to set up his brewery. He said, I believe a beer of a different kind would flourish in the United States. You know, do not follow, you know, he said, just because Montreal, the beer in the United States, is 3-4% adjunct lager beer, mm-hmm. a good beer will always find different customers. And I believe But for Prohibition, but for World War One, but for the Depression, but for World War Two, we probably might have had a craft revolution, if you will. Again, this pure speculation. But because it was a start and stop, that it didn't have an opportunity to get legs. It just so happened the Greatest Generation, the beer that they grew up on after repeal and the end of Prohibition, was an adjunct lager beer. You know, you get and some of it, you got, it's a hoot to read the transcripts. You know, in Guadalcanal, guys are sending letters back saying, "Hey, this lager beer by this brewer is great," and the brewer saying, "You know, it's 20% cassava, for example, in it." You know, so by the time that generation came, the blissful years of the 50s and 60s, you know, I think it continued longer than it normally might have in terms of dominance, because that was the beer they grew up on. That was their first beer. And it wasn't until their children, you know, in the 70s and 80s, came of their own right. And I think that's a rite of passage for every generation to change things. I think that's why craft came in. That's why fatigue, if you will. But fatigue, that's, you know, in let's 1980s to 2020, that's almost a 40-year period, has only whittled away 20% of the overall market share. You know, it's still got legs as a style, but the fatigue, I think, was a big factor. But I raised the point in the book, again, pure my opinion based on a career in the industry, but on that march to lightness I referred to earlier, you know, we've lost since the 1980s, you know, the domestic beer production has plummeted significantly for the first time, you know, other than Prohibition, all that kind of, you know, we got our imports, we've got craft. But I think, you know, in terms of the industry, we've stopped brewing a lot more. We've stopped brewing a lot of beer since 1980s. It makes sense. I mean, they're heavier beers to drink, right? But I talk in my this book about the march to lightness. I think we're already seeing evidence of it, even in the craft world, with you know, the interest in lagers, the interest in hard seltzers, which is now a factor within the craft community, and the interest in non-alcoholic beers. You know, lightness in terms of alcohol. So I think that march to lightness can still take legs and reverse that curve. You know, and spur domestic growth, domestic production of fermented you know, products like seltzers and lager beers that the craft brewers are also making.
Now, since you have some historical perspective, I want to get your opinion here on the dominance of IPAs in the craft beer industry, and it's well over 50% of the craft beer produced now is one style, arguably.
Yeah. In a way, it's kind of, you know, like the equivalent of the dominance of Pilsner style lager amongst all the various categories of lagers prior to Prohibition and the decades after. You know, I think that's that's the personification of, okay, we're not making a light drink of beer. This is our statement as a generation. We're going to revive. And even that, but, you know, even that, though, I find parallels with the past, Brad. You know, the IPA of the United States world is not the IPA of European IPA, right?
Right.
I mean,
it's clearly a unique style.
Yeah, it's in our DNA as a people, and they talk about that. You know, Frederick Pabst wrote this book about the American brewing industry in the 1890s. He said, to the credit of the Americans, we mess with things. We just can't take status quo. And that's what we did with the adjunct Pilsner of Germany, because it was born there. But the style and the way that it evolved was clearly American. I see the same thing happening with so many different styles in the craft world, where they're taking the old world, you know, style, and then, you know, making it an American version of that. But I think to me, the fact that, you know, IPAs, I don't know how, I haven't been following the statistics, Brad, but I suspect it's probably peaked, if not slight decline, as other styles are coming in, a little bit of fatigue, you know, kind of like a parallel as the Pilsner evolved to be lighter, so too did, you know, the juicy, the hazy IPA. You know, I could, if I get a, I just, I won't name names, but I always, you know, typically will have an IPA as well as a craft lager. And of course, our son, his farmhouse ales, if they're available as well.
Well, I wanted to give you a minute here at the end to walk through your books. I think you have three volumes coming out at the moment, right?
Yeah, the first volume, the series title for all three volumes is The Inspiring History and Legacies of American Beer. And it may strike people as odd, the word inspiring. In terms of adjunct lager beer, because that's essentially what lager beer was in the United States up until the craft revolution. But it was a very deliberate choice because the history is a fascinating history. And I've broken it up into three volumes. The first volume covers the period 1941 to 48. And I, as an overall theme, I'd say that's about preserving that period. It was more about preserving the heritage, American heritage of adjunct lager beer through difficult times, but rewarded by massive explosive growth before it returned to where it was. Second volume is Born in Germany. That's the title. And it covers that overlapping period between the 1850s when it's first started, as we talked earlier, in the German Empire.
Right.
Well, it wasn't the Empire then, but you know, in Germany up till 1906, and it covers that period. And the profound influence. It's impossible to talk about the American journey of adjunct lager beer without assessing the German, because they were so intimately linked. And then the third, that's the one, you know, particularly really inspiring. And it covers the period in the decades leading up to Prohibition, the battle that was fought by the industry to protect the right of the American brewer to brew the materials of their choice. The irony of it being corn and rice, not, you know, grains of paradise or, you know, any other exotic spice or whatever that, you know, might be used today, but it was corn and rice contextually. The battles that they fought were inspiring to me. And that's when I talk about their legacies, not just succeeding in making beer a national beverage, but also protecting the rights. And, you know, every craft brewer to me and today that is brewing with anything but malt, hops, water, and yeast, that's a legacy that needs to be appreciated, because the right to have that was almost lost. And it was literally, and I'll go through by, you know, each state, the federal, the Supreme Court, the media, the medical, everybody was saying, stop making this beer. And they were very public. They were very proactive. They were very passionate about their right to do that. And even, you know, for example, Frederick Pabst, he sued the state of Missouri for a ban on corn as in his PAPS. And he couldn't even pass through the state of Missouri with it containing corn. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. In 1902, the Supreme Court ruled for the state of Missouri, saying, yeah, they have the right to, you know, it wasn't passed as a food safety measure. It was passed, again, follow the money, purely as a tax, an inspection tax, which was silly because there's no way of proving chemically whether they use corn and rice, but it was just money, opportunity to build macadamized roads at the time. So roads for them and ships for the Kaiser. But yeah, so that's kind of the quick skinny, if you will. On
so
the
I mean, tree. We actually, it was interesting that, though, you mentioned this earlier, but we actually came close to having an American Rheinheitsgebot, right?
Yeah, it really started in the first real organized attempt was 1890, and that gets back to the very first part of this podcast about the Turner Adulteration Bill, which was introduced. Bills read in both the House and the Senate in terms of you shall only use these ingredients to make lager beer, and they were bills read. And I talk about this in the book. The only reason that it was introduced as legislation, and this also is fascinating, the transcripts. Who's losing money, right, when they're using adjuncts? The malting industry, which was a pretty powerful block, and they were actually read into letters from lobbyists, DC attorneys, to the malting companies, if you give us this much money, we will agitate in the press of government to ban the use of these adjuncts. And when that got right into the transcripts, McKinley, who was then chair of the, you know, Senate Ways and Means Committee and future president assassinated in Buffalo, he said, well, this is commerce. This is a safety issue. So that was the first time, 1890. But then it really was from 1890 right up to 1911. Mm-hmm. There was repeated efforts by congressional, you know, Pure Food Congress, you know, the Food and Drug Act of 1906, in, you know, trying to standardize what could be used to make every type of food and beverage in the United States. And it culminated in 1911 with the What Is Beer hearings in Washington, D.C. So we came really close, and it all overlapped, you know, with that same period, but for different reasons. You know, Germany, it was to get Kaiser enough funds with the reforms to the imperial tax law, where everything changed and it standardized to malt, but also dramatic increase in the same legislation for cigarettes and train tickets. And, you know, it was built, you know, Reichstag had this huge table of showing the models of the size of the German Empire's Navy compared to Great Britain and France and the United States. It was kind of like, every legislator had to walk by it and get into the chamber. So, I'm going to rub some feathers, I'm sure, this book the wrong way in terms of myths and paradigms. But I'm going to let the history do the talking for itself and see what people think.
Well, Greg, just want to get your closing thoughts on the rich American lager beer history, which often gets ignored.
Yeah, thanks, Brett. I mean, really, it's my aspiration and hope that this trilogy, I'm not going to make a penny on a single book. I mean, I'm just not. Everything that would be an author royalty, I'm going to be donating to taps.org. If you're interested, it's a group that really provides fantastic support for military families that have lost a parent. And we've had a lot of that with National Guard disproportionately involved in Afghanistan and Iraq. So anything that would go to me is going to that. So I'll just redirect it. So really my hope is I find this history so inspiring. And at a time in the United States where perhaps history, the word inspiring might not be linked, whether I agree with that or disagree is moot, but it's clear that within society, I'm really passionate about telling a story of inspiration of a generation of immigrants that overcame incredible obstacles to have their imprint made on the American fabric, the American culture, the American industry, and now globally. So I'm hoping people, when they read this, because I know it's a history that's been forgotten completely. We're not typically the best in the world for understanding history, for example. Depressing how many didn't know if Norris or South Vietnam was an ally or foe when it's a 50-50 proposition. But nevertheless, we forget history pretty quickly in the United States. And I think this is a fascinating history. And it's a history that I think, if appreciated, I'm retired, but I believe it'll be a benefit to the entire American brewing industry, whether it's craft, macro, home, just to see, look at that glass of beer a little differently. Whether it's a Bud Light because of the corn and rice or a Coors Light, or whether it's a craft beer that's using some exotic ingredients other than just the Fab Four, if you will, that'll spur growth in the industry. That'll be very positive for the industry that I have great passion for. And if the public sees beer differently than they do today, that once all these stories are out and hopefully a documentary will follow the books, it gives a visual to it as well. That we'll see beer differently in society, and it'll be just a good thing for anybody that loves to brew beer in the United States of America.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for being here. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Oh, that's awesome. Thanks for taking the time, Brad. I can't tell you how much I've been looking forward to this and how much I appreciate your interest in providing the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a closet historian, so I enjoy all of history, actually.
Yeah. That was always... Even as a kid and all through my adult life, I've never read science, even though it was my thing. I've always read history. I've never read, different talks, particularly European history of the 19th and 20th century, because how profound of an influence that was in the world then and still today.
Well, again, my guest today was Dr. Greg Casey, former president of the ASBC and author of an upcoming, I think it's MBAA trilogy on American lagers, right?
Correct,
Thank you again, Greg. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. Appreciate it. Have a good day.
A big thank you to Greg Casey for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, the Beersmith website, web-based version is out now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. You can try Beersmith Web for 30 days by setting up an account at BeersmithRecipes.com. If you purchase a gold, platinum, or pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version for one low price. Check out BeersmithRecipes.com to give Beersmith Web a try. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great Brewing Week.